Welcome to WhiskeyCast, the cask strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie, and this is episode number 67 for November 19th, 2006. Coming up in a few minutes.
When I retired in 1986, the owners at that time said, Elmer, we'd like to name a bourbon after you. I said, fine, you can do it, provided you let me pick the bourbon. So they agreed, and I'm picking the bourbon for it still.
There are only two living bourbon distillers with a whiskey named after them, and Elmer T. Lee is one of them. We'll hear his story later, but first, let's look at the news. The biggest whiskey news of the past week came out of Calgary, Alberta, Canada, where what may have been one of the most expensive casks of single malt scotch ever went on sale. Willow Park Wines and Spirits in Calgary is now the home of a 1975 Glenfiddich single cask that the store acquired from William Grant & Sons for $100,000 Canadian. It's only the fifth single cask ever sold by Glenfiddich, and the previous buyers include British Airways for the initial launch of the Concorde, the launch of the Queen Elizabeth II, and the Crown Prince of Denmark's royal wedding. Willow Park got the other one last year, a 1974 cask that Willow Park owner Wayne Hennessy says sold out in 6 weeks.
What's really interesting is we've got the 74 and the 75. We've got no more 74s left, but the 75 is a completely, it's got a real orange peel nose, where the 74 had a real caramel nose. And so they've got different noses, but boy, you can tell they're so smooth compared to, you know, just the regular Glenfiddich. Even the 21 or the 18-year-old, this is so much nicer.
The 1975 cask produced 350 bottles that are selling for $600 Canadian each. They went on sale this past Wednesday at Willow Park's Whiskey in the Warehouse event, and a third of them have already been sold. You might be wondering, why Willow Park? It's one of the biggest retailers for Glenfiddich in North America. By the way, Willow Park is also hosting a Brooklady tasting with Andrew Gray on Wednesday, November 22nd. I've talked a lot in the past about award-winning whiskeys, including last episode's announcement of the Malt Advocate Awards. But if you've ever wanted to have your say in a whiskey competition, Kevin Erskine is ready to give you a chance. Now, Kevin is the publisher of the Scotch blog. We've talked with him several times before on WhiskeyCast. He's created the Drammy Awards. He's accepting nominations in 9 different categories, including one that I can guarantee that the winner will not be sending out press releases for, the most overrated whiskey of the year. There's a link to the Drammy's website at WhiskeyCast.com. Now, one of the other Drammy's will go to the Innovator of the Year. One potential candidate would be John Glazer of Compass Box, who created the groundbreaking and highly controversial Spice Tree earlier this year. John's latest whiskey is hitting the markets now, and it's called Oak Cross.
About half of it, I put it through a second maturation in what we have always called oak cross casks. The casks are American oak bodies, used American oak barrels, onto which we have the coopers put new French oak heads. Heavily toasted, new French oak, an oak that's normally used for winemakers, sold to top winemakers. Now, your next question is going to be, well, this technique sounds somewhat similar to what you did for Spice Tree. What's the difference? Big difference. With Spice Tree, we were inserting very high-quality staves with an extremely heavy toast that you can only get on flat staves. That was a different thing altogether and a completely different style of whiskey. Oak Cross is a light, delicate style of malt, whereas Spice Tree was a big sort of... quite a big heavy malt with quite a big influence from the oak. Oak Cross just has a subtle influence of French oak. The clove spice and the heavy vanilla character from the French oak just adding an extra layer of complexity to the malts.
While Oak Cross is available around the world, if you're traveling through Canada and spend any time in Ontario, check the LCBO stores for John's other new creation, an Ontario-only exclusive called Magic Cask. Last year, Glengoyne released a series of single malts selected by its stillman. This year, the distillery's mashmen are getting a turn. Jim Leslie, Charlie Murray, and Peter Andrew have chosen a 15, 17, and 20-year-old cask, respectively. The bottles are available at Glengoyne Distillery and a limited number of specialty retailers. If you're in New York on December 5th, it might be worth making a call to the Palm Steakhouse. That's the last stop in McAllen Ambassador Casper McRae's fall series of whiskey dinners at Palms around the U.S.
Palm Restaurant is obviously a beautiful steakhouse. I like to eat very well wherever I go in America. So we thought a very good way of assuring I ate very well and we could showcase some wonderful McAllens was to do some whiskey paired dinners with the Palm Steakhouse as well. So it's an opportunity for people to come along. Obviously the food is going to be exceptional. But we've carefully chosen some particular McAllens from either the Sherry Oak range or the Fine Oak range, which will go particularly well with every course. And so you'll arrive very informal, have a good cocktail to start, then I'll take you on a quick guided tour of Scotland and single malt whiskies, sit everyone down, we'll have some great food, but I'll come around every table and sort of answer your questions individually, tell you anything you might like to know about the whiskies or the distillery or Scotland, and just should be a very convivial evening.
Now, if Beaumores are more your taste and you're in Europe, there will be a Beaumore tasting that same night with Morrison Beaumore's Jamie McKenzie at the Ramada Hotel in Nuremberg, Germany. This week, they're celebrating an anniversary at Aberlour Distillery in Banffshire. The 22nd is Founders Day, the day James Fleming fired up the still at Aberlour back in 1880. Other events coming up over the next few weeks, the Landoris Whiskey Society will hold a tasting on Friday the 24th in Hofstad, Belgium. The Whiskey Ship 2006 Whiskey and Cigar Festival starts on the 29th in Zurich, Switzerland. Maker's Mark will hold its annual holiday candlelight distillery tours on the first two Saturdays in December. That's the 2nd and the 9th. That night on the 9th will also be the final event in the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's U.S. Chapter Series of Fall Scotch Tastings. This one is in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Of course, there's a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. As I mentioned earlier, there are only two living bourbon distillers with whiskeys named after them. Jimmy Russell of Wild Turkey is one, and Elmer T. Lee is the other. He's 87 years old now, and is the master distiller emeritus at Buffalo Trace. He's also credited with coming up with the idea of marketing single-barrel bourbons. I sat down with Mr. Lee at Whiskey Fest New York earlier this month, and here's his story.
It's been a long time, but how did you get involved in the whiskey business?
I grew up in the town that Buffalo Trace is located in, and I knew it from my kid up. After I got out of college with an engineering degree, they were looking for engineers, and I was interested. I went to work for them in 1949.
What was it like growing up around the distillery back then?
Everybody knew the distillery and the distillery people. They were friendly, a good place to work. It was just a sort of a big family atmosphere.
But it wasn't always that way. If I remember correctly, there were a number of those years when you were growing up when there wasn't a Buffalo Trace distillery because of the Great Experiment.
No, it operated during that period of time. One of the four distillers in Kentucky that continued to operate under a medicinal permit and made medicinal whiskey and bottled. And people who had a pain went to their doctor, got a prescription, got it filled. They could get four bottles a month, was it? Four pint bottles a month. And cured their ills.
I never quite thought of it as medicinal, but I can understand why.
It's labeled as such. You look at some of those old Prohibition era labels, and it says bottle for medicinal purposes.
Now, what happened after Prohibition ended and the distillery kicked back in full strength producing bourbon for everybody?
Well, there was, I don't know, 200 or 300 distilleries in Kentucky, and quite a number of them went under during the Prohibition era. So when they started back up in 1933, 34, why, of course, they didn't have any aged bourbon. They had to start all from scratch again. and they went full blast. They went good.
Tell me about your first day working at the distillery. What was it like to go in there on that first day back in 49?
It was a hustling place. At that time, there was about 400 people working at the plant. It was a big operation and a lot of people hustling around doing their thing. And my first day at the plant, I was just trying to find my way around the plant and find out what I was supposed to be doing.
And what did they have you doing?
I was an engineer, plant engineer, which meant that you took care of building needs, maintenance needs, new construction, new equipment, modernization, mechanization, the things that engineers do.
And how did you make the transition into distilling?
After about 12 years of this as an engineer, the plant was pretty well where they wanted it to be, and they offered me an opportunity to learn the distilling trade as a art and to understudy the master distiller and the plant manager. This I did, and after about 4 years, I became manager of the plant.
What to you makes a good bourbon?
What makes a good bourbon? Takes a good recipe. It takes a people who are interested in what they're doing and do it with pride and care and put it away in the warehouse and age it for the required number of years, bottle it, put it on the market.
Did you ever expect that you'd spend your entire life pretty much there?
No, I didn't. But after I was there a few years, like most people would, I shopped around in other industries and quickly decided that I was where I belonged, and I stayed with it.
Tell me about the average day when you go into a distillery. When you go in there, what's it smell like? What's it sound like? For those of us who've never been to a distillery, sort of paint that picture for us of what it's like in there.
You would be impressed, I think, with the sugar smell. It's a sweet, the mashing of the grains and the conversion over to with barley malt, the conversion over, you get a sweet smell. And this impermeates the whole area around there. This is what you'd witness or would be impressed with first, I think, is the smell. And then, if you was interested, you'd want to find out where that good smell was coming from and take a tour of the plant, and they'd offer you a little drink of their bourbon, and you'd like it.
What's the secret, in your opinion, to storing and aging bourbons? I know a lot of folks like to rotate their barrels around the warehouses and stuff like that. And what's your secret? What do you think makes it age so well?
Well, the territory we're in is Kentucky's climate is constantly changing. The Army guys had a good word for it, said if you don't like a weather in Kentucky, just wait a few minutes. You know, it's going to change. The changing seasons, the changing weather is very important to the aging of bourbon.
How so?
With the increased temperatures that occur, it forces the whiskey in the barrel into the wood. And the wood is, of course, got a lot of sugars and taste characteristics about it that when it cools off and withdraws from the wood, it brings those tastes with it. You get all of the, most of the taste and all of the color comes from the barrel, the aging process. When it's first made, it's clear as water and put in a barrel, and in a few days it'll pick up some color and we'll start to take on characteristics of bourbon.
Now, I know that a lot of people differ on the amount of aging a barrel should have. What's your opinion? What's the ideal age for a bourbon?
It depends on a person's preference, taste. But to my taste, 7 to 10 years is where it reaches its peak, I think.
Does it go downhill after that in some ways?
Depends on your taste preference. It does change taste as it ages. You pick up more of the tannins, more of the wood taste. If you like that, you like it older. If you don't care for it too much, you'd prefer it at 8 to 10 years age.
Now, what's changed about the industry over the years, both good and bad? What don't you like about the way things have changed, and what do you like?
Well, there's not many things that I don't like about it. There has been a change, of course, in the equipment, modernization, mechanization, computer control, this sort of thing, which is good, I think, because it gives you better control of your process. So you put out a product that's consistent year in and year out. Those are the good things, I think. The bad things, and they're not really bad, but I hate to see the thing become too mechanized and too modernized. It takes the romance out of the operation.
And whiskey making really is sort of a romantic, passionate type thing. A still maker or still man handing out, working over the still, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, you retired a few years ago officially, but do you miss it?
Well, not too much, because I go in quite frequently. I retired 20 years ago, and I still go into the plant on a routine basis once a week, do a series of tastings of the single barrel products, and serve on a committee that selects barrels for single barrel production. Then I touch base with folks like Angela and Mac and the personnel people, the gift shop. You know, I just make myself at home and roam around.
How do the bourbons today compare? Because you talked about being able to get more consistency with computer control. Are the bourbons of today just as good as the bourbons you were making back in the 40s and 50s?
Yes, it certainly is. In fact, it may be a little better because of the consistency. With the controls that's now on the process, with instruments and computer and people who pay attention to what they're doing, you put out a more consistent product, and it's a good product. I think it's better than what we did in the 30s.
I know your colleagues over in Scotland would say that the whiskeys they were making back in the 50s and 60s are superior to what they're making today just because of changes in barley and things like that. But it's interesting to hear you say that you're actually making better bourbon now than you did 30, 40 years ago.
To my taste, yes, we're making better bourbon.
I have to ask, since you're talking about taste, how do you take your bourbon?
How do I taste it? Well, at the tasting panel, you have some distilled water, rinse your mouth with distilled water, and then you take a sip of the product that you're tasting, swirl it around in your mouth, let your taste buds in contact with the product, and if you like it, why, you like it, you know, you spit it out, and then you do the same thing for the next sample that you...
If I remember reading correctly in your bio, you're sort of the one who came up with the idea of marketing single barrel bourbons. Am I correct on that? Why did you come up with that idea? How did you come up with it? And what did the folks at the distillery say when you said, let's do single barrels?
The owners of the plant at that time was looking for a premium product that they wanted to be in competition, so to speak, with the single malt scotch program, which was very successful. So I was manager at the plant at the time, and they came to me and says, what would you do? How would you suggest we come up with a premium product? And I remembered some of the things I had learned when I first went to work there from Colonel Albert Blanton. Whenever he wanted bourbon for his own personal use and for entertainment, he'd go to his favorite warehouse and ask them to bring him samples out of aged bourbon, 7, 8, 10 years old. He would sip them, and he would pick a particular barrel and say, bottle that one, that's the one I want. This sounded like a pretty marketable idea to the people that owned the plant. So they said, we'll come up with a single barrel bourbon. So the first one was Albert, named after Blanton, Albert Blanton.
Tell me about Colonel Blanton.
Well, I only worked with him 4 years before he retired. He was a true Kentucky gentleman, quiet, good-natured, knew his business, had a great love of the plant and the products. He was part owner of the property at that time. He was a real gentleman. I like Colonel Blanton.
And now we're looking 40, 50 years later, and now you've got your name on a bottle of bourbon.
Yeah, I have. When I retired in 1986, the owners at that time said, Elmer, we'd like to name a bourbon after you. I said, fine, you can do it, provided you let me pick the bourbon. So they agreed, and I'm picking the bourbon for it still.
And what do you look for when you pick that bourbon?
Something that's very mild and mellow to my taste. I like the caramel, the sweetness that I get from it, the vanilla, oaken flavors, all of those things that are pleasing to my taste is what I look for.
I know that you and Jimmy Russell are the only two distillers alive that have your own have a bourbon named after you. That's got to be something of a matter of pride for you.
It is. There was three of us, of course, Booker Knoll, who's now passed away, but they're the only three distillers that I know that have a bourbon named for them. Jimmy Russell's, Russell's Reserve, Elmer T. Lee, and Booker's.
Let me ask you one final question. What do you want your legacy to be in this business? How do you want people to remember you 20, 30 years from now?
I want people to remember me as being knowledgeable of the business, the craft, and someone who was fair and honest in dealing with them. I want people at the plant to remember me as a good manager.
And a good whiskey maker.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was part of it. That's right.
Again, Elmer T. Lee is 87 years old, and if you'd like to know more about his bourbon, there's a link to the Buffalo Trace website at whiskeycast.com. Coming up in the next episode, I'll sit down with Lincoln Henderson for a tasting of Suntory's single malt Japanese whiskeys. But that's all for this episode. Whiskey Cast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2006, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.